Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Back in June of 1993, a ship called the Golden Venture ran aground near Queens, New York City. There were almost 300 illegal Chinese aboard. They had started out in Thailand and had made a very difficult trip of 120 days trying to come to the United States. This was part of a wave of Chinese that came to America in the late 80s, a lot of them from Fujian province. Many of these people ended up living outside the law, working in a shadow economy run by New York City's Chinese gangs. This morning, in this part of the show, we will introduce to you a figure who came to dominate this Chinese underworld, a middle-aged grandmother known as Sister Ping. She was the person who was very heavily involved in organizing the voyage of the Golden Venture and some other people smuggling efforts as well. In fact, she may well be America's most famous and most prolific people smuggler. She's what's known as a snakehead, a person who is indeed a people smuggler, what we here in this country would call a coyote. And we'll talk this morning with someone who's written a book about this particular story and about this woman and the people that were associated with her. And the title of the book is The Snakehead, An Epic Tale of the Chinatown Underworld and the American Dream. Doubleday is the publisher, and the guest is Patrick Radden Keefe. He is fellow at the Century Foundation. He's a graduate of Columbia College, Cambridge University, London School of Economics, and Yale Law. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker, to Slate, many other publications. Also frequently comments on NPR, BBC, CNN. In fact, an earlier version of this story did indeed appear in The New Yorker. And the book is just out, and it's a very interesting story. So you might seek it out in the bookstore. Questions here are also welcome as we talk. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief and on point here, on topic, so we can keep things moving along. But again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Keefe, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I think that the case of the Golden Venture, people might have a vague memory of this here. I'm sure that it got more coverage on the East Coast than here, and we are talking about something that happened quite a number of years ago. Let's start there. Tell us about the Golden Venture.
Well, on June 6th, 1993, about 16 years ago, very early in the morning, just a few hours before dawn, a couple of park police officers were doing a routine patrol in Queens, New York, along the beach there in Rockaway, which is right out there on the Atlantic. And in the dark, they saw a mast light very close to shore. And as they got out of the car to investigate, it turned out that there was a freighter there, kind of a tramp steamer, that had run aground a couple of hundred yards from shore, and the sea was very rough. And as they looked out in the dark, they saw that people were actually jumping off of the ship and into the water. And it turned out that this ship actually had almost 300 illegal Chinese immigrants on board. And a huge rescue operation was launched. It was one of the biggest rescues in New York history. One of the guys who was there on the beach that day likened it to a plane crash on the high seas, picking these people out of the water. And 10 of them ended up dying, swimming to shore. And it turned out that this ship had actually come all the way around the world. It had made a 17,000-mile journey with these illegal immigrants on board and had washed up in New York City.
Mm-hmm. This case really got the attention of the U.S. government. The Clinton administration was in at the time, and they felt that something had to be done. They really had to crack down and had to make an example of the people who were involved. At the time, though, how many other ships like this had come to the United States in the same way and perhaps not had this kind of trouble and not got this level of attention?
Well, this was part of the irony with the Golden Venture, is that it arrived in this very public, sort of spectacular fashion on the footstep, really, of the doorstep of the media capital of the country. And it was right in New York City, and within hours of the ship arriving, you actually had news helicopters, and cable news was broadcasting images of this, and it was on the front page of every paper the next day. But it turned out, as you point out, that in the previous kind of 2 years leading up to the Golden Venture, almost 24 ships had actually come. I mean, 24 that we know of had come and deposited Chinese passengers on the shores of the U.S. So there was really kind of a boom tide of ships making this journey in the wake of Tiananmen Square at a time when a lot of people were trying to get out of China and come to America.
Mm-hmm. So there was something going on at this time that prompted this wave of people who were trying to come. Did most of the people that came at that time come illegally, or were there also people who came legally?
There were people who came legally, but it was still very difficult to leave China legally and to come to the U.S., to actually get visas to do it, and particularly from this one region that people came from, Fujian province. I mean, this is one of the strange features of this story, is that China is this huge country. But in the last 3 decades, the vast majority of people who've come from China to the U.S. come from this one tiny little part of it. It would be as if we were to go to China today and all the Americans there happened to come from Providence, Rhode Island. It's this kind of strange phenomenon. And because so many people came illegally from Fujian province, it actually became harder for them to get visas, even visas just to come and visit, because the sense was, oh, you'll probably stay and live illegally here. And so a combination of a whole series of factors meant that by the early 1990s, a lot of people were trying to make this journey. And nobody knows how many people came exactly, but just to give you a sense, I mean, these numbers are always rough, but in the mid-90s, the CIA estimated that roughly 100,000 people were coming illegally from this part of China to the U.S. every year.
Mm. This Fujian is one of the coastal provinces. It's in southeast China. It's right across from Taiwan. Is there some particular reason that anybody can think of why it was that this particular province was the departure point for so many people who wanted to come to the U.S.?
Well, there are a few reasons. One is that historically, what people have done in Fujian province is leave. It's this little kind of sliver of coast, which is just across the strait from Taiwan, and it's separated really from China by mountains on three sides. So it's sort of mountains separated off on three sides, and then you have the coast on the fourth. And there's always been a big fishing and seafaring culture there. And in the 18th and 19th century, many Fujianese left and actually settled around the Pacific Rim. So if you go to Indonesia or the Philippines today, there are these big Chinese communities, and they're mainly Fujianese. And in fact, in Taiwan, when we talk about Taiwanese, the dialect spoken in Taiwan is very similar to the dialect spoken in Xiamen, which is a city in southern Fujian province, because so many people in centuries past left that area and went and actually settled in Taiwan. So that's one reason. There's another reason which is kind of strange, which is that you would think that people must have been fleeing terrible poverty in Fujian province at this time. But as I got into my research, I learned that this was not, by a long shot, the poorest part of China at that time. In fact, the economy in Fujian was doing better. It was improving about, you know, it was growing about 10% a year. And it turns out that it's not absolute poverty that makes people leave their countries, whether legally or illegally. It's what demographers call relative deprivation. So it's basically, you know, if everybody in the village has been doing badly and sort of living a fairly meager lifestyle, and they always have for generations, then people aren't necessarily inclined to leave. But when economic reforms came to China in the 1980s, some people in Fujian province started doing better than others. So suddenly you would see your neighbor, and your neighbor had a refrigerator or a car, and you didn't. And that kind of comparison was part of what drove people to leave.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Patrick Radden Keefe, and we're talking about his book, The Snakehead. It's recently been published by Doubleday. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, if you wanted to get out of China and you couldn't get out legally, then you would go out and seek the services of a snakehead. What is a snakehead?
Well, snakeheads were these kind of immigration brokers that sprung up actually in the 1970s when a lot of people were trying to leave mainland China and get into Hong Kong. And what would happen is if they couldn't do it legally, they would pay a smuggler, and the smugglers had many ingenious ways of getting them through. And Sister Ping, who's one of the major figures in my book, was a woman who grew up in Fujian province. And she actually came legally to the United States in the early 80s. She was sort of part of the very beginning of the wave of Fujianese who came. She came on a visa, but almost immediately she started sending for people illegally. And at first it was her family, and then her extended family, and then people from her village, and then people from surrounding villages. And nobody knows exactly how many people she brought, but, you know, it's speculated that we're talking tens of thousands of people over the years. And she would actually charge quite a hefty fee for this. So if you were in China and you wanted to come to the U.S., you would find someone who was in Sister Ping's network and could let her know that you were trying to get out, and you would make a little down payment on the fee. And in the 1980s, the fee was $18,000. By the 1990s, it was $35,000. So this was a very lucrative business. Again, nobody really knows in terms of the precise numbers, but to give you another estimate, I spent a lot of time interviewing the FBI for this book, and the FBI estimates that over the course of 10 or 15 years of doing this, Sister Ping made about $40 million.
It's really a stunning amount of money. Was she indeed the biggest, as far as anybody knows, individual? And we also would have to say that she didn't do this by herself. She had this network of people who were her family and then associates and people who were involved in Fujianese gangs in New York and all. But for any one individual, would she be the most successful?
So far as we know, yeah. I mean, and the most successful, you know, probably the most prolific and certainly the most famous.
She also, in addition to doing this, she did operate legitimate businesses in New York's Chinatown.
Yeah, I mean, this was one thing that really struck me about Sister Ping, the better I came to know her story, and then eventually when I actually was able to exchange questions and answers with her. This woman was first and foremost, I would say, not a criminal, but an entrepreneur. She thought of herself as a businesswoman. And she had a very ruthless, callous attitude toward American law. But for her, this was all about business, whether licit or illicit. So there was this funny thing I realized, you know, she worked out of a restaurant on East Broadway in Chinatown, this little kind of noodle restaurant. You wouldn't really look at her twice if you passed her on the street. She was fairly inconspicuous. She didn't dress in a very fancy way, didn't drive fancy cars. She was always appeared to be working in the restaurant. She had a whole string of other businesses, a real estate agency, a legitimate travel agency. She owned a garment factory in China. She owned an arcade in Hong Kong. She owned an ostrich farm in South Africa. She had businesses all over the world. And people will sometimes refer to these as front businesses, as if to imply that, you know, her real business was human smuggling, but she kept these fronts to look as though she was a legitimate businesswoman. But if you think about it, this woman was so business-minded that if you had a front that wasn't generating its own healthy profit, that would be kind of wasteful. So what she did was she set up these other businesses, and they all began to prosper on their own.
Clearly, she knew what she was doing was illegal, but she also seemed to think that she was providing a valuable service, and a lot of other people in the community apparently thought so too. How did she think about what it was she was doing?
Well, she did know it was illegal. I mean, that's the first thing to say, is that she took a great deal of care in camouflaging and masking her operations. I think she knew that she was violating all kinds of laws in terms of what she was doing. And certainly she gained a reputation within Chinatown. I mean, this was part of what I found fascinating about her to begin with, is that even as in the minds of law enforcement, this was the most wanted Asian organized crime figure for the FBI, and the FBI ended up spending almost a decade chasing her around the world and really kind of holding her up as a villain, somebody who'd done some pretty terrible things. In Chinatown and in China, she was revered as a saint, as a an almost kind of a Harriet Tubman figure who had ushered all of these people out of poverty in China and brought them to the U.S. so that they could build new lives. I've never been able to decide whether or not she truly believed that about herself, or whether that was an image that she cultivated and kind of sold to the neighborhood. But certainly in my exchanges with her and in her own interactions with other people who I've interviewed and in her encounters in court, she's pretty self-righteous. I mean, she portrays herself as a pillar of the community, someone who was just looking out for her country people, and someone who's actually been kind of victimized by American law enforcement. Hmm.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. Someone who is listening in Champaign on our line one. Hello?
Hello. Presumably, these people came here to work, and I seems like I heard on NPR or somewhere, someplace, that just coincidentally in this time period, there's been a proliferation, in, at least here in the Midwest anyway, of you know, Chinese buffets and Chinese restaurants and so on. You know, you can't get Chinese food in this town. You're not looking because they're just all over the place. And I seems like there was a report or an implication anyway that many of the people that are working in these places are sort of here in kind of an indentured servitude. They were forced to come work for somebody for a certain period of time in order to pay off their passage fees and so forth, if we can call them that. If you would comment on that, if you knew anything about it, and of course, I'm sure during the course of the program, you'll tell us what happened to this interesting person and where she is today.
Thank you.
All right.
It's a great question. Thank you. Two answers, I guess, to that. The first is that you're absolutely right. I mean, this proliferation of Chinese restaurants is very closely connected to the influx of people coming from Fujian province. Most of the people who have come over end up, at least initially, working in the Chinese restaurant business. And, you know, they're somewhere in that continuum. I mean, if you're kind of less motivated and bright, then you end up pushing a mop or slicing broccoli. And if you're more bright and motivated, you end up owning the restaurant or owning a chain of restaurants. It's also the case that a lot of these immigrants, whereas in the past people might come to Chinatown and stay there, a lot of the Fujianese I interviewed basically said, why would I want to do that? Think of it from a business point of view. Why would I want to open up a Chinese restaurant in a Chinatown on a street full of Chinese restaurants with all this competition? What I want to do is actually go out to other parts of the country where there aren't a lot of Chinese restaurants, and I want to open up a Chinese restaurant that's the only one for 20 miles around, and that way I know that I'll do much better in terms of my business. So I think probably that's some of what you're seeing, is that a lot of these Fujianese migrants came and then spread out across the country, and when they did, a lot of them opened restaurants. To get to the second part of your question, it's complicated, this question of whether or not they're indentured, because there's a misconception, which I had when I started researching this book, which is that the snakeheads bring people over here, and they owe the balance of these big fees. And then they're basically indentured to the snakeheads, and they're working as sort of virtual slaves for years for the snakeheads. But when I started asking around about this and actually talking to snakeheads and talking to people in Chinatown and actually going to China and asking people about this, they said, think about it for a second. From the snakehead's point of view, that doesn't make any sense. If you're a snakehead, you're smuggling perhaps thousands of people to the U.S. You don't want to spend years chasing after different people who owe you debts. So what would happen is people would get over here and they'd have about 72 hours as a grace period to pay off their fees. And I should say, a lot of the time what that meant was that you'd be in a safe house, there'd be a gangster or a snakehead pointing a gun at you, and they'd give you a telephone and they'd say, call everyone you know, your family, your friends, anyone in China, in the U.S., borrow the money so that you can pay us off. And people would borrow very small amounts of money from everybody they knew and pay off the snakehead in about 72 hours. And at that point, the snakehead's kind of out of the picture. But the migrant then has this big debt and is still indentured in a sense, if you think about it, but they're sort of indentured to their family and friends more than they are to the snakehead.
And then what happens is then whatever it takes over the next few years, these people end up working very hard, living very frugally, getting to the point where they can pay off this debt. And then maybe they start thinking about some family member that's back in China and they think, well, now we'll bring somebody else over. And this kind of process gets repeated over and over again.
That's exactly it. There's a very evocative Fujianese expression, which is one brings 10. 10 bring 100.
And just to touch on the other thing that the caller mentioned, and we can talk some more about Sister Ping. He said something about, where is she now? Well, she's in jail.
Yes. So what happened with Sister Ping is that I should say a little bit about the Golden Venture and the role that this ship played. Initially in the 80s, Sister Ping had a very hands-on operation. She was sending people primarily by plane And she would basically have phony documents or a phony visa. Often what it was is that corrupt officials in Guatemala, believe it or not, or some other Central American country, could be paid to make a visa or generate a visa for a Fujianese migrant. And they would get a flight to Guatemala that maybe had a layover in an American airport. And when they got to the American airport, they would just walk out. Or alternatively, if they went directly to Guatemala or, you know, not via the U.S., when they got there, Sister Ping and her ring would basically pick them up and smuggle them with the coyotes, I should say, often in partnership with them, up through Guatemala and Mexico into the U.S. But by the early 1990s, the demand for passage was so high that it became difficult to do this in a kind of retail fashion on planes. And so Sister Ping and other snakeheads started sending people in the holds of ships. And to give you a sense of how serious the demand was, I mean, at this point, you're going in a ship, which is much more hazardous. It's a longer journey. It's dangerous. But the price didn't go down. It went up to $35,000. And the Golden Venture was one of these ships, which Sister Ping actually didn't play a huge role in. She helped finance it. And of the 290-some-odd passengers on board, two of them were her personal customers. The others were paying other snakeheads. Though I should add that one of those two was among the dead, who died on the way to the beach. When this ship arrived, Washington kind of woke up to this problem. And the FBI and what was then INS, and is today Immigration and Customs Enforcement, really got a mandate that you need to go after these snakeheads. And so what they did was they started pursuing the gang that Sister Ping had worked with and the various snakeheads who were involved, and then they started going after Sister Ping. But she was a wily customer. And in 1994, the Justice Department was putting together an indictment. The FBI was about to come and arrest her. And on the eve of the indictment, she fled the country. And it was the last time she traveled on her own passport. She flew back to China. She went back to her home village, where she, as I said before, was regarded as kind of a Robin Hood figure. And she continued to live there and do her business for the next 6 years. And the FBI knew exactly where she was. But when they appealed to the Chinese government to arrest her, they wouldn't extradite her. And I think there are probably complicated reasons for that, and we can talk about them. Mm. But she basically managed to continue with impunity, and she kept sending ships and got very, very rich. And it was only in 2000 when she passed through Hong Kong, and the FBI got some intelligence saying she was going to be in Hong Kong, where the authorities cooperated a little more closely with us, that she was arrested. And she was eventually extradited to the U.S. and tried in 2005. And during the trial, all of these snakeheads and gangsters she'd worked with turned on her and testified against her. And at that point, she was convicted and sentenced to 35 years in prison. So she'll be in prison for the rest of her life.
Yeah, given her age, that essentially is a life sentence.
Yeah.
Our guest, we're just about midway through this part of Focus 580. Let me just very quickly introduce our guest once again, Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author of The Snakehead. It's a book that tells this story. The subtitle is An Epic Tale of the Chinatown Underworld and the American Dream, published by Doubleday. It's just recently come out. He's contributed to a number of publications, New Yorker, Slate, others. Is a frequent commentator on NPR, BBC, CNN, and you can find the book now. It's a good story. Questions are welcome, and we have somebody else here standing by, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is a caller in Champaign here, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. The person that's being exploited, I know, for example, that in Chicago you have Chinatown, and you have these Chinese restaurants in these various locations, and they have the van, they pick up the Chinese. I mean, they work 7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day for a long, long time. So, I mean, some people's health suffers from that. But I don't know. They're exploited. You know. So I don't know what your take on that is. But you say, well, you don't know in terms of what her, you know, she's sort of helping people and all that. But some people are really hurt by it, you know. So you have any comment with that? Or
I do, yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating issue and one that I wrestled with throughout this book, because I think there's no question, and I shouldn't. If I've given the wrong impression, I should be careful to clarify here. And if you read the book, I mean, I think I make it pretty clear in the book. I have no doubt that Sister Ping and snakeheads like her really exploited people, a whole variety of reasons. But I think the first one is they're exploiting people's belief in the American dream.
Sure.
There were people in China who wanted to get out, and they were willing to mortgage their own lives in order to do so. And she took big fees, and she put people on dangerous ships. And, you know, 10 people died on the Golden Venture. There was another ship that Sister Ping sent to Guatemala in the late 90s, which overturned, and over a dozen people drowned in that incident. So I don't mean to suggest for a moment that this is a good person, and I think she is exploiting people.
But, I mean, you know, we have the situation with the Mexicans in the same way. You know, Americans won't do that work, and these people go out in the field, and they're shifted from one area to another. I mean, we have a culture of exploiting people. But
yeah, and we have we have a demand for it. This is the other issue, right, is we have 12 million illegal immigrants in this country.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of them are doing work for below minimum wage. And a lot of them are doing work which, frankly, even in these economic times, other people wouldn't do.
Right.
And, whether we like it or not, this is a fact of our economy. And if you were to deport the 12 million tomorrow, we would take a big hit.
We wouldn't have
the cost of living would get a lot more expensive.
Yeah, we wouldn't have vegetables.
That's true. Exactly. You know, one thing that was difficult, though, and this is what I wrestled with, is that I spent the last 3 years interviewing undocumented Fujianese people who came to this country. And there's no question that they work in conditions that are often shameful and exploitative. There's no question that, these are people often who get 2 days off a month, if that. They basically work for 14 days straight, and they get a day off. And they're working around the clock, and they're living in pretty wretched conditions. And if they get injured on the job, there's no workers' comp. And a lot of the time what will happen is the employers will basically withhold their pay and say, oh, I'll pay you next week, and they keep doing that. And the migrant doesn't know what to do. Do you just walk away because you're afraid that you're doing this work for free, or do you hang around because maybe the boss will eventually give you the paycheck? And you can't really go to the cops because you're undocumented. These are terrible situations. But in talking to people, they go into it with their eyes open. They often know what they're getting into. And this was the thing, just from a moral point of view, that was difficult for me to wrap my mind around. Was I would say to people, boy, you know, you got on this leaky ship, and then you knew you were going to come here, and the conditions were going to be terrible. You'd be making below minimum wage and working for years like a dog. And they would say, yeah, I know, but that's the sacrifice I'm willing to make. And for most of them, the reason is their children. Because they would say, look, if my kid is born in the U.S., he or she is a U.S. citizen, and someday she will grow up to be American and to go to college and to sort of join the mainstream. And if I have to sacrifice myself, you know, if this generation has to make that sacrifice, then that's a sacrifice I'm prepared to undertake.
Let's talk with someone else here. Line one, this is also someone in Champaign. Hello?
Yeah, I was just wondering to what extent, if your guest is aware that INS or whoever is working on this subject is aware of this technique of snakeheads, and you know, we see a lot in the popular media about the efforts on the border to control people coming across the border, but meanwhile the Mexican border I'm referring to, that Mexicans are, you know, using this same sort of model to get large numbers of people across who have means and so forth, and the people that are trying to come across the border are the most destitute or the least capable, and you know, that's really the small issue where you've got thousands of people working around that through snakeheads. That's the question.
Yeah, it's what was the INS, which is now Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Department of Homeland Security, they're definitely aware of it. They, to some extent, my book is a story of the learning curve for law enforcement, because when this stuff first started happening in the 80s and through the early 90s, the FBI and the INS didn't really know what they were dealing with. There was a huge level of sophistication in these rings, and almost anything that we did in terms of throwing up a roadblock, they would be able to route around. And I think, you know, one interesting kind of paradox here is if you look at the border with Mexico, or frankly also the border with Canada, which the snakeheads have used over the years and continue to use. In the late 90s, about 10 years ago, there was a ring which was sort of half Fujianese snakeheads and half Mohawk Indians smuggling people over a reservation, which is sovereign Indian territory, into upstate New York. And they were caught eventually. The ring was dismantled. But over a two-year period, they made $160 million doing this. So this is very sophisticated business. And one of the paradoxes is the tougher you are on border enforcement, the harder you make it for someone to basically just walk across the border, the better it is for business, for the snakeheads. You know, it's only when you actually couldn't cross yourself through the desert or over the Niagara River or whatever it is, that you need to turn to a coyote or a snakehead who's a little more sophisticated. I mean, the analog with drugs is pretty good. In a way, the tougher you are in enforcement, the more the rewards, the financial rewards, for the bad actors who are in the business.
Yeah. Another really interesting piece to the story, I'd like to at least have you tell a bit of it, was the cooperation between Sister Ping and her people and this gang, this Fujianese gang in New York. It was their job, apparently, to take smaller boats, go out to the big boat, and ferry people to shore. And what happened here was there was a falling out between members of this gang, and one bunch of guys killed some other guys, and those were the guys that were supposed to go out and meet the boat. And what happened was then there was no one to go out and meet the boat. And if that hadn't happened, perhaps the story of the Golden Venture would have been different.
Exactly. I mean, what they did was they wouldn't bring the ships right to shore. They'd keep them out in international waters. And then usually these street gangs would take little fishing boats out to meet them and offload people quietly like that. And you're exactly right. I mean, things could have worked out very differently with the Golden Venture, because this gang was supposed to go out and meet it and could have picked people up, and nobody would have ever been any the wiser. They would have come in inconspicuously in fishing boats to ports around New York or Massachusetts, as had happened with other ships in the past. But Sister Ping had gone into business, basically, with a guy named Ake, who was the head of one of these street gangs. And the book is about the story of this relationship between these two very different criminal characters. Ake was a murderer. He's a very violent guy. But he ran this gang. And the plan was that the gang was going to go out and meet this ship. But there was a big shootout, because they were generating so much money through this snakehead business that the gang was sort of fighting over how to share the profits. And so nobody was there to meet the ship. And that was really the reason, this shootout that happened just a week or two before it came in at a safe house, a gang safe house in Teaneck, New Jersey, was the reason that the Golden Venture ended up running aground. The interesting postscript to this is that Ake, this really ruthless gangster who was also involved in the Golden Venture incident, he ended up getting arrested not too long after the ship came in. And when he came into the FBI, pretty much the first thing he said to them was, "I can get you Sister Ping." And so this is a big part of the story in the book, is that the FBI started working very closely with this gangster to actually try and apprehend Sister Ping. And when she was finally tried in 2005, 12 years after the Golden Venture came in, he was the star witness against her.
So they were so intent on getting Sister Ping that they were willing to let this guy walk, knowing that he had this very long, serious criminal record that included several murders.
Right, exactly. So this is a guy who had pled guilty to 5 murders. And he was also fairly young. I mean, he was in his late 20s when he was arrested, so he's probably in his early 40s now. And Sister Ping, when she was tried, was almost 60. And he testified against her, and she was put away really for the rest of her life. But at this point, she's kind of a little old lady. She's a grandmother. And this guy who pled guilty to 5 murders was quietly let out the back door. I mean, no matter how you come down on these situations, I think it's hard not to be conflicted when you hear about that kind of a decision by prosecutors.
Yeah, we talked about the fact that Sister Ping, she was caught, she was tried, she was sentenced to 35 years in prison. Anybody know where AK is today?
He is in, well, people know, but he's in witness protection. He's been sort of relocated. As one of the FBI agents joked, he's flipping pizzas in Idaho.
the administration, I'm sure that when it came to the people that came on the boat, that these Chinese that had come illegally to the United States, they were in a difficult position. They had these people, all these people that had survived this terrible voyage to come here, and yet what they were doing to come here was illegal. What did they do with them?
Well, the Golden Venture actually, in terms of immigration history, was a big turning point. Because part of what was complicated about this story is that under the George H.W. Bush administration, we had made it quite easy for people coming from China to get asylum, particularly after Tiananmen Square. The idea was basically that if you could get here and you could say, I was a pro-democracy protester, or if you could say, another big issue was the one-child policy, China's one-child policy. If you came and you said, my family, we wanted to have more than one child, and the birth control cadres, the population control cadres, threatened to force me to have an abortion or to sterilize my husband, then it was actually quite easy to get asylum. And so a lot of the passengers on the Golden Venture came hoping to ask for asylum when they got here. But because of the spectacular nature in which they arrived, what we did instead was we threw them in prison. And at that point, that was a pretty novel thing to do, that you have asylum seekers who come to the U.S. and they say they're fleeing persecution and they want to stay. And what we do is we lock them up and say, look, well, we'll figure out whether or not you're telling the truth, but in the meantime, we're going to lock you up, even if it takes years. And a lot of the passengers on the Golden Venture who had endured a pretty hellacious voyage, I mean, to give you a yardstick, the Mayflower, when it came to Plymouth Rock in 1620, the voyage of that ship took 60 days. And in 1993, the voyage of the Golden Venture took 120 days. And once the passengers arrived, we threw them in prison. And a lot of them were in prison then for the better part of the next 4 years. And the irony there is that since the Golden Venture, that has become the norm. So now immigration detention is actually the fastest growing form of incarceration in the U.S. And it's really the norm. We could have somebody who comes here today from the Sudan and says, I'm fleeing torture in the Sudan, and we'll say, well, we're going to lock you up in prison for the next couple of years while we figure out whether or not we believe you.
Let's take another call here. We have someone in Champaign County here where we are, line one. Hello.
Well, in the last few minutes, you opened up a whole bunch of things, but I think I'll try and just focus on the, since the time's limited, that promoted me to call, which was, I know your story is about the U.S. situation, but I wonder whether beyond that you might speak about, you know, this as a more international phenomenon. It's like in the U.K., I think the only people that are picking mussels and cockles these days are pretty much Chinese immigrants, and they had a disastrous thing, incident that highlighted that some time ago. So that sort of dimension, and then kind of that gets into population pressure and economic dislocation, that this is a worldwide phenomenon. So I guess I can ask you to comment on that if you could.
Yeah, I mean, great question. And the, you know, the Fujianese are unusual in that they do tend to go all over the place. And Fujianese, you know, to this day are leaving for Japan and for Europe and for Australia. But there was a particular allure of the U.S., which was different. And, I mean, believe me, I've talked to people who crossed the Niagara River in the dead of winter in order to get from Canada to the United States, to which I can only reply, what's wrong with
Canada? Yeah.
Wouldn't be too bad a place to stay. But you're absolutely right that this is a huge international phenomenon as well. The cockle pickers in the UK are a great example. And in fact, you know, several years ago, the Morecambe Bay tragedy, there was a terrible incident in which the tide came in and many of these people doing this very hazardous work died, and they were Fujianese. They were all from Fujian province. And look, more broadly, even outside the Chinese context, global irregular migration, people leaving developing countries or poor countries, or countries like China, which actually are increasingly prosperous, but the wealth isn't really all that widely spread within the country, and going to better off countries, is a huge issue, and the flows are happening around the planet. And as these flows continue and grow, the snakeheads and the coyotes and the various kind of brokers who manage this are getting more and more sophisticated. And I think, you know, look, the analog with the drug smugglers is a fairly good one. The bigger the business, the higher the rewards, the more sophisticated they become.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I want to thank the caller and invite others. We have certainly time for a few more calls. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Patrick Radden Keefe. And he is the author of the recently published book, The Snakehead, subtitle An Epic Tale of the Chinatown Underworld and the American Dream. It's published by Doubleday. Number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You had an opportunity to talk with some of the people who were on the Golden Venture. How are they doing now?
Well, it varies. I interviewed a bunch of people. There's one guy in particular, Chung Sing Chow, who's taken on the American name Sean Chen, who's sort of one of the central characters in the book. But I interviewed a lot of them, and they're still in a difficult position in that very few of them were granted asylum. Have I lost you? Are you still there?
No, yeah.
Sorry, I suddenly... very few of them were granted asylum. And when they were eventually let out from prison in 1997, they weren't put on a path to citizenship. They were paroled out. So they're still in a kind of nebulous state where they're not really allowed to be here. Basically, the government could decide tomorrow that it wants to deport these guys. And it's been really difficult for them in terms of establishing lives here. Because these are people now who own businesses, a lot of them. They own property. They pay taxes. They've had American-born kids. Many of them have ended up marrying while they're here. And so there's a kind of permanence. You know, there's all the things you would want to be doing if you were becoming a stakeholder in American society. But at the same time, there's always this risk. And what's happened is, one by one, they've been getting picked off. And so I actually just yesterday saw one of these guys who is living in Buffalo, New York. And about 18 months ago, he got a letter from the government saying, look, you know, you're just a parolee. You're not really supposed to be here. We're going to deport you back to China after all these years. Please collect your life into 50 pounds of luggage and report on such and such a date. And this guy has had two kids in America. And he called one of the various kind of legal advocates and attorneys who have been helping him out over the years and said, which kid should I bring? It's a difficult kind of nebulous existence that these guys are living on the one hand. On the other hand, they love it here. They love this country, and they really ardently believe in it, and they wouldn't go back to China. They don't want to. And so, you know, in that respect, it's a story which it's not an unqualified happy ending. But, you know, their determination to come here and to be here and to stay here is undiminished.
Yeah. You sort of wonder why it is that the government, it was decided that it's worth whatever kind of resources they have to expend to round these people up and after all this time to send them home.
Yeah, I mean, I really have trouble wrapping my mind around, particularly because for the book, I actually tracked down the New York district director of the INS, the guy who, back in 1993, first made the decision to detain the Golden Venture passengers. And I told him, these guys still don't have green cards. And he said, well, that's ridiculous, because given that they're parolees, they have to check in once a month with immigration. You know, there's administrative costs associated with them being not perfectly legal. And he said, those guys have paid their dues. We should let them be normal citizens, which is kind of funny coming from the guy who originally decided way back when to lock them up. You do have to wonder. I think that part of it is that given that we're not able to deport realistically the 12 million illegal immigrants who are here, in recent years, particularly in the later years of the Bush administration, a policy was adopted which is basically that you're almost sort of harassing people on a one-off basis. You try and make life so unpleasant that you'll actually oblige people to turn around and go back on their own. And it sort of happens piecemeal, but the idea is that this is maybe a way of dealing with the process. I think it's not very effective, and I think it's cruel.
Probably there is nobody now in the snakehead business that is as dominant as she once was, but I take it that when she was arrested and her operation was shut down, other people stepped in to provide the same service?
Yeah, that's correct. She, I think that the business has changed to some extent, and in a weird way, what's happened, at least in Fujian province, is we've seen market saturation. Everybody who wanted to come came. So it's slowed down quite a bit, but there still are snakeheads in the business. The fee now, I'm told, is about $70,000. And I would predict that if the economic crisis continues and continues to sort of put the pinch on manufacturing in southeastern China, you're going to see a lot of people out of work. And we've already seen a huge internal migration within China away from the coasts back to the ancestral villages that a lot of these migrant workers left behind. I think if that continues, you're going to start seeing people paying snakeheads, and we may see an uptick in the trade again.
One of the parts of the story I thought was interesting, you talked about the fact that at one point so many people were coming from Fujian that the province was starting to actually empty out.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, when I went a little over a year ago and spent a couple of weeks kind of tramping around the countryside there in these villages that people had left, there were these eerie villages. They call them widows' villages. And you go in and there are these – the first thing that's kind of conspicuous is that in these rural villages, there are these big mansions that have been built with money sent back through underground banks like Sister Ping's from people working in the United States. So you have these huge kind of incongruous mansions rising out of the rice paddies, and then there's nobody in town. A lot of the mansions are actually boarded up because everybody actually lives in the U.S.
And apparently at one point there were so many people who had left Fujian that then the remaining people in Fujian actually had to import labor from outside of the province?
Yeah. When you see manual laborers now, I mean, again, it's a little different in the last 9 or 10 months, but when I was there about 18 months ago, you know, the economy was booming, and there were all kinds of construction projects. And all of the construction workers are from Sichuan, because anybody who could conceivably be a construction worker in Fujian has left.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could talk about some of the other things that Sister Ping did for the people that she helped to come over, because once they got here, they would need jobs, they would need a place to live. And she also apparently, as you mentioned, facilitated this remittance of money from people who were here in the United States. They were making money, and a lot of the money that they made, they sent back home.
Right. So she had this this underground bank she developed. I think this is kind of a good snapshot of her business acumen. She was bringing these customers over, and they were saving money to pay off their snakehead debt, and then as soon as they could, they would try and send some money back to their families in China. And they needed a way to do that was kind of cheap and quick and easy, and there was no danger that they'd have to show ID and might get in trouble with immigration. And so she started offering a service where she would move the money back. And it was a really ingenious system she set up where the money didn't move. She basically had a big store of cash in New York and a big store of cash in Fujian province. And people were sending money back and forth all the time because, remember, people in China were often sending money to New York to pay off snakehead debts. And so what she would do is, you know, if you went in and said, I want to send this money to China, you would give her the money in New York. She would add it to the pile in New York. And then the next day, somebody would take that same amount of money from the pile in Fujian province and bring it to your mother in the countryside. And at the end of the month, she might need to balance the books and make sure that, you know, she had the right amounts in each place. And what she would do is she would get her husband to just bulk carry cash from one place to the other. And he was actually arrested on numerous occasions in airports, you know, with a suitcase with tens of thousands of dollars in it.
So earlier on, we talked about how much money that Sister Ping had made. Was this the money, the figure I think I recall I noted down was $40 million. Was that just from people smuggling, or this was all the associated businesses that she was involved in?
According to the FBI, that was just from people smuggling.
Just from people smuggling.
Yeah.
So she must have no doubt made a tidy sum from some of the other things that she did, including the legitimate businesses. As you said, she was such a good businesswoman that she said, well, if you're going to have a front business, that better make money too.
You want to make money as well. And listen, I mean, I just 10 days ago, I was in New York City and I had lunch at her family's restaurant, which even though she's sitting in a federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut, the family's restaurant at 47 East Broadway is going strong. And if any of your listeners are ever in New York City, I'd encourage you to visit the Young Sun restaurant at 47 East Broadway.
So you had the opportunity to meet and talk with her?
Not to meet her. What happened is, it was funny, I spent several years trying to persuade her to talk with me. Her initial response when I made my first overture through people in the community, which I thought was classically Sister Ping, was, what's in it for me? And when I sort of persuaded her that I wouldn't pay her for an interview, that that would seem a little journalistically dubious, or give her some of the royalties from the book, she eventually came around, and I actually managed to persuade her lawyer as well. But the prison wouldn't let me in. And there was nothing I could do in order to actually get in and see her face-to-face. So what we did was we devised a system where I would send questions into the prison with an interpreter, and she would answer them, and they would come back out to me. So we actually had a pretty extensive exchange, but it was kind of an interview on paper.
Yeah. We I mentioned earlier that this story, what did get some attention nationally. It was a big story in the New York area, understandably enough. And that was when you yourself got interested in this?
No, I got interested much later. I mean, huh. You know, to show you my age, I was in high school when the Golden Venture came in. But I had just finished law school 4 years ago in 2005. Huh. And I'd published my first book and was sort of thinking about what I wanted to do for my second book, but also thinking maybe I should be a lawyer, and studying for the bar exam in New York City. And at that time, Sister Ping was on trial in New York, just a few blocks away from where I was studying. And I found it very difficult to concentrate on my studies for the bar, and very easy to follow this trial. And that was that. I passed the bar, but I never became a lawyer, and I pursued this story instead.
Yeah. Well, for people who want to read the story, and it's a good story, the book you should look for is The Snakehead, and the subtitle is An Epic Tale of the Chinatown Underworld and the American Dream. Doubleday is the publisher of the book, by our guest Patrick Radden Keefe. And Mr. Keefe, we just want to say thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.